This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices, episode 396, was produced on October 5th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. Forest for the Trees founder Luke Groman returns as this week's feature interview guest. Luke and I will deconstruct the dollar bond yield relationship and discuss treasury yields running away this week and where they're headed next.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, October 4th, 2023. The Macro Scoreboard is brought to you by BigPictureTrading.com. The S&P 500 December futures were down 37 basis points, closing at 42.97. Decisive selling continues a third week in a row. We will have a closer look at that chart and at the key technical levels to watch in the post game. The U.S. dollar index up 11 basis points, closing to 106.77, a breakout to new 2023 highs. The November WTI crude oil contract down 1,010 basis points, closing at 84.22, a dramatic reversal after hitting $94 highs. We'll look at that chart in the post game, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. The November RBOB gasoline futures down 1,373 basis points, closing at 220. Also, a material reversal in gasoline futures, now 50 cents off their September highs. The December gold contract down 296 basis points, closing at 1835. The breakdown now testing March lows. Copper down 137 basis points, closing at 359, also trading back to the 2023 lows. Uranium down 127 basis points, closing at 7010, finally paused its advance after a solid 1 month run higher. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 13 basis points, closing at 4.74, a material breakout in yields pushing to fresh weekly highs. The key news to watch this week, the much-anticipated job numbers, and next week we have the U.S. CPI and PPI inflation numbers and the University of Michigan consumer sentiment. This week's feature interview guest is Forest for the Trees founder, Luke Groman. Eric, why do we get Luke back on the show this week?
Well, we just had Brent Johnson on recently. Brent and Luke tend to be kind of opposites in the sense that they both see the U.S. dollar system as in slow motion breakdown, but they've had in the past very different views. So when Brent told us he thought that the dollar index could be headed to new highs above 115, I thought surely Luke was going to be the guy to say, no way, can't happen, uh-uh. Now, Luke still has a long-term bearish view for the dollar, but just listen to what he says in this interview about what could happen between now and then.
Well, Eric's interview with Luke Groman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Forest for the Trees founder Luke Groman. Luke, it's great to get you back on the show. Feels like it's been too long, although it really hasn't been. I really want to talk to you about the U.S. dollar. Our friend Brent Johnson says he thinks we could get a retest of that, 115 that we saw on the dollar index. Looks to me like if it got that far, it could go all the way to about 122 or so, which would break a lot of things. Is that a possibility? Are we looking at the potential of the dollar moving even higher than it's been? And if so, what would the consequences be?
Yeah, I think it could move that high. And in terms of what would the consequences be, that would break the U.S. Treasury market. That would break Western sovereign debt markets. That would break U.S. banks, Western banking systems. It would accelerate even further de-dollarization of global commodity markets. You know, headline today that China and Brazil just did a deal end-to-end in yuan, which would only send the dollar higher, force more deleveraging. So it would break the U.S. dollar system. It's a paradox that most people seem to think that the dollar rising is a sign of the U.S. winning. It's not. It's a sign of the U.S. dollar system unwinding itself.
Let's go a little deeper on that. When you say it's a symptom of the U.S. dollar system unwinding itself, obviously, you know, to the casual observer, there's an counterintuitive. You know, you'd think if the system was failing somehow, the dollar would be crashing. How is it that the dollar appreciates? What's the mechanism and how long does that last? Does it reverse at some point?
No, it reverses when the Fed steps in and prints enough money to buy enough treasury bonds. Yeah. But until that point, you know, I've been saying on Twitter and to clients, the beatings will continue until the dollar is weakened meaningfully and oil prices are dropped meaningfully. So how the rising dollar breaks the list of things I laid out is essentially by increasing the net effect of supply nonlinearly. In other words, every tick higher in the dollar forces foreigners to sell more treasuries. They own $7.5 trillion in treasuries, $3.8 trillion at the central bank level, most of which is longer duration treasuries. So as the dollar rises, their cost of servicing offshore dollar debt rises. They need to sell something to defend their currency, to raise dollars, to service dollar debt. And so what do they sell? They sell what they can, not necessarily what they want to. They sell treasuries. So that adds to what is already a very problematic supply-demand dynamic in terms of the U.S. running a two-point, you know, trailing 12-month deficit is about 8.5%, just short of 8.5% to GDP. Every tick higher in the dollar increases treasury supplies. Then as the dollar goes higher and as foreigners sell more treasuries, that sends rates up, which then feeds back into the dollar, which then feeds back into treasury sales, which sends rates up, which then feeds back into the dollar, which sends rates up. And so we are living that feedback loop right now. And then where it starts to get really nasty, if that's not nasty enough already, is U.S. banks own $4.1 trillion in U.S. treasuries and agency mortgages. They've sold down from, call it $4.6 trillion to $4.1 trillion over the last 18 months. As rates go up, they start to have credit losses. Way back in 2014, some of these treasuries were taken on by the banks as high-quality liquid assets to sell, that they could sell because treasury markets are the deepest and most liquid market in the world, trademark U.S. Treasury 1985. So they turned seller. And, of course, they're kind of stuck on one level because if they sell, they got to take the marks of the loss that they've already lost money on in treasuries. But they need to sell something because commercial real estate's getting worse as rates go up. Credit cards get worse as rates go up. Car loans get worse as rates go up, et cetera, et cetera. So now every tick higher in the dollar drives every tick higher in yields, which drives the banks to join in the nonlinear, very convex increase in the net effect of supply of treasuries. And so you can see how this dollar feedback loop will continue. Now, the reason why this is bad for the U.S. is that ultimately we're a financialized economy. And you're talking about taking down treasury market. You're talking about taking down the banks. And, you know, I know Brent would say, hey, it's also going to take down the Europeans. Yeah. And that's like sort of like, hit, you know, the U.S. bombing U.K. before Hitler started sending V2 rockets over there and, you know, bombing France in 1939 to soften them up for Hitler. But importantly, the weaker these nations get, the Japanese, again, they are our creditors. They own $18 trillion in U.S. dollar assets on a net basis. They own $7.5 trillion in treasuries on a net basis. As they get weaker, they will sell treasuries faster. And that's why I think he's right that you could see this feedback loop. There's really no limit on where the dollar could go. I think the variant perception is, you know, at DXY 200 or 250, paradoxically, you're going to have, you know, oil shortages or gasoline shortages throughout the United States because global supply chains have broken down, which is, I think, a very counterintuitive thought. That's how I'm thinking about it.
Let's talk a little bit more about the policy that got us here and maybe where that policy is headed, because it seems to me that as rates were starting to back up, people said, okay, look at interest rates. Oh my gosh, how far is this going to go? And the answer was the Fed's going to keep hiking rates in order to fight inflation until they break something. Then Silicon Valley Bank happened, and a whole bunch of people said, okay, this has got to be it. They broke something. They broke something really big because it was those backing up rates that put so much pressure on Silicon Valley Bank and other banks that failed around the same time. Well, surely that means that they have to pivot now. They've got to go dovish. And almost everybody thought that had to be the last hike because of Silicon Valley Bank. In reality, what it meant to the Fed, I think, was, that Silicon Valley Bank thing was a big deal. We should pause for a good solid month or so before we hike rates again. And, you know, that didn't stop them from continuing. It seems to me like inflation is not going away. Is the Fed going to continue to hike until they break something much bigger? And how big of something has to break before they're satisfied they've broken something?
This is a challenge of what they have done, particularly when married with what the Biden administration did with SPR releases last year. SPR releases plus aggressive Fed rate hikes were functionally oil price controls. And Eric, you and I both know price controls work in the short run. They do. And then they make the problem a whole lot worse. Because what you do is send a false signal for a brief period of time to the markets. And so the market stops growing supplies based on the price cap. And so then all of a sudden you get this surprise at the back end of, oh my God, why are prices rising even faster now? This doesn't make sense. Well, of course it makes sense. And so what the United States did last year in response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine was effectively institute price controls on oil, which is a really good idea if you are not the world's biggest marginal high-cost oil producer whose decline rate of shale is anywhere from 5 to 10 times the natural decline rate of Russian and Saudi oil, which, of course, is exactly what is true. So I think the Fed did not give any thought to what rate hikes would do in terms of acting as an artificial price control on U.S. shale production. And now we're on the back end of it. I think the gambit was, hey, we're going to break Russia and we'll break China with rate hikes and oil price caps, and it'll be just like it always is. And the problem, of course, is that they ran the old same old playbook with a completely different set of circumstances. And so what we're starting to see is oil prices pick back up. Well, why is that happening? Well, you know, as I've warned over and over and over, 90% of global oil production growth over the last 10 years, according to Enverus and Göring Rosenzweig, came from U.S. shale. And so what the Fed did with rate hikes, because shale is interest rate sensitive and has a higher decline rate than Russian oil or Saudi oil, and what the White House did with SPR releases, as aggressive as they've been in 40 or 45 years, was to put a bullet in the growth of U.S. shale production. It's rolling over now, per the EIA.
No, wait a minute, Luke. I definitely agree with you that there is a much steeper decline rate on any given U.S. shale oil rig as opposed to the conventional plays that you see in the Middle East. But in terms of total production, remarkably, in the wake of the pandemic, the U.S. shale patch has recovered almost completely back to almost new all-time highs. EIA is still reporting, I think, 12.9 million barrels versus 13.3 was the previous record. But there are other reports that are already indicating that U.S. shale, in terms of total production, not individual wells depleting, but total production, is right back up there with where it was pre-pandemic.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. And rig count is not, as you know. And production follows rig count on a lag of, call it, whatever, 3, 6, 9 months. It's probably more like 6 to 9 months. And rig count started rolling over, I think, late last year. It's starting to maybe bottom out now. And critically, the EIA pointed out for October, Permian's down. Production in the Permian is down in September. So that's the big mother right there. And that has been much slower declining than all the others. All the others are, that's, you know, the Permian's the only one of the big four that is set new highs post-pandemic. All the others aren't even close in terms of their pre-pandemic production. You know, Niobrara, Eagle Ford, and Bakken. So we're seeing it roll over. The point is that what the U.S. did with oil price caps is now bouncing. It's now boomeranging back like price controls always do. And that is in turn reverberating into the inflationary impulse. And that is in turn reverberating back into the Treasury market. So that in turn is reverberating back into the dollar. There's this feedback loop that is just, it is feeding back on itself in multiple ways. And the higher oil goes, the more treasuries foreigners have to sell to get dollars to buy oil. And so it was the price controls the U.S. put on oil last year were very penny-wise, pound-foolish, and they're now feeding back in two ways. The bounce in oil and inflation by extension, and the treasury market, and that feeds back into the dollar. So it is, and that's not to be clear, that's not to say U.S. oil production can't grow. What it is saying is for U.S. oil production to grow will require a much higher price of oil, and that much higher price of oil over time will increase inflation, which will increase treasury selling, and which will increase rates, which will increase the dollar, until you get this break we talked about, which is the fundamental mismatch. Is the price of oil you need to keep U.S. shale growing will break the treasury market. It generates an inflation rate that breaks the treasury market. And that's fine if you're Volcker in, you know, 1981 and U.S. debt to GDP is 25-30%. And U.S. deficits are 2% of GDP. But U.S. debt to GDP is 120, and entitlements are cash flow negative, and deficits are 8.5% of GDP. So there's simply the supply is so much higher. Like, we can't afford the rate of inflation we need to keep shale growing. It's this fundamental mismatch that is contributing to and accelerating this feedback loop in the treasury market and the dollar, that there's no brakes on this thing.
I agree with you in principle. I mean, in theory, that makes perfect sense to me. What I'm having trouble digesting, though, is how is it that the shale patch has done such an amazing job of recovering from the pandemic? A lot of experts said, oh, look, you know, the only way they ever got to 13.3 million barrels was a mountain of easy money from the Fed in the wake of the, you know, 2009 event and so forth. It's never going to happen again. Well, it has happened again. Against all odds, they're back to, you know, these incredible production levels. How is it possible that we're managing to produce all of this oil, and how much longer can we continue to grow it?
At the end of the day, the answer is price, right? Oil went to 120 last year in March when Russia invaded. And then we got priced down and rig count rolled over. And so, you know, there's a lag on the production. There's been an element where there've been much longer laterals, right? You've seen a record in terms of, you know, the laterals that they've been using. But you can see the productivity numbers are starting to roll over. You can see production in Permian is starting to roll over. And so, again, it's a function of price, but critically, the oil price needed to do what they did is fundamentally incompatible with $2 trillion deficits and 120% debt to GDP and the DXY at 107. Like those, you can't have all of those things at once. The release valve will be dollar up, treasury market up, feedback loop, unless the Fed steps in and stops that feedback loop.
Moving on from oil, let's talk about some of the other consequences of that feedback loop. You know, some of the predictions that we've heard over the years were a bunch of bloggers that were saying, you know, someday China and Russia are going to divest their U.S. Treasury holdings. And when they do, look out, baby, because it's going to crash the market. And, you know, there's going to be martial law in the United States, the world, the sky's falling and so forth. Well, the crazy thing is the prediction came true. The China and Russia did divest much of their treasury holdings, but no such thing happened. It was a complete false alarm. The next prediction, though, was, boy, if we ever got back to 5% treasury rates, that would push the U.S. cost of borrowing so high and so far beyond tax receipts that you would have an abject fiscal crisis in the United States starting the next morning after, you know, Treasury yields managed to hit 5%. Well, guess what? We've had quite a few next mornings after Treasury yields hit 5%. Those things haven't quite happened yet, although I'm not sure that they're not in the works. What do you see in terms of things actually breaking? Are there leaks in the dam yet? And where do you expect them to start springing up, if not?
Oh, my goodness. The leaks started a year ago. You know, when the UK gilt market broke, that was a leak. What was the U.S. response to that? You know, Janet Yellen ran down the TGA at a record amount, injecting massive dollar liquidity into the system, completely more than offset Fed QT for over a quarter, or for certainly for most of a quarter. And the dollar weakened about 15% in 4 months, which is an enormous decline. That was, you know, September of last year. So 5 months after the Fed, 6 months after the Fed really started getting aggressive. It didn't take long. The next leak was, you know, Signature Valley Bank. Like these bank problems were not bank problems. They were treasury market problems. The Fed had the choice of saying, no, you know what? We're not going to do BTFP. We will not do swaps where we'll swap you dollars at par on treasuries that are down 30%. Sell them. We told you to hold those as HQLA when you ran into trouble. And now you're in trouble. Sell them. And what would have happened? The banks would have sold into what was a very sloppy market. You could see it. The MOVE index, the Treasury Volatility Index in March was at 160. Banks would have sold. That would have driven basically the Treasury move we're seeing right now, the yield up every day, you know, 10-year up 10 basis points every day. That would have happened in March. So that was sort of leak two. 2Q, you basically had no issuance because of the debt ceiling. And that made things seem like it was okay, better than it was. And 3Q, like, here we are. And so, you know, when you say, hey, Russia, China, they you know, if they sell, they'll crash the Treasury market. Anyone that would have said that would have, that's misunderstanding some various fundamentals and misunderstanding what happened and understanding the paths, right? So what do I mean by that? I mean, China and Russia did sell and nothing happened. Why did nothing happen? Well, you can look back in time. In 2014, banks were regulated into buying treasuries. 2015, money market funds were regulated into buying treasuries. 2017, under Trump, pensions were regulated or incented via tax breaks into buying treasuries. And so, you know, banks, they went from owning $1.8 trillion in treasuries and agencies in 2014 to 4.6 by 2021. Money market funds, their owning of government, you know, of T-bills, you know, the switch from prime money market fund to government money market fund, was $2 or $3 trillion in treasuries they bought, T-bill, mostly at the front end. Pensions went from, you know, I had the number in front of me the other day, several trillion dollars from, or a couple trillion dollars, excuse me, from 2018 to 2020 to date in terms of treasuries. And then more recently, you've had, you know, twice the biggest marginal buyers have been hedge funds in this relative value trade. And most recently, the Fed has incented U.S. retail to pile into treasuries over the last year with the rate hike. So the point here is that there have been cracks. They've been papered over. And that as soon as China and Russia stopped, it set off a scramble by U.S. authorities to do something that is very familiar to people that have invested in Brazil and Argentina, et cetera, which is, oh, crap, we lost our biggest source of foreign financing, foreign central banks. We need to encourage our own domestic investors to buy this stuff. And that's what they did. Banks, money market funds, pensions, hedge funds. And it worked. It worked for 10 years. And now we're reaching the problem, which is all of those incentives, the HQLA and the money market funds and the pensions, were all based on one fundamental view, which was inflation will never return. Except between COVID and the stimulus and now peak cheap oil, inflation is returning. And I just said, you know, the geology of shale is such that to grow production, you need price to rise over time to levels that are not conducive with low inflation in the United States and not conducive with a treasury market size, a market this big without foreign sponsorship in a way anywhere near the size of our deficit. So, like, what we're watching right now in the U.S. and around the world is the bursting of the global sovereign debt bubble that I've been talking about, you know, most of the times we've talked for the last several years. Like, it's happening right before our eyes. It just took a primrose path. And, you know, U.S. authorities have had a lot more leeway to deal with it by virtue of being the reserve currency issuer and having all these piles of money that once foreign central banks stop buying this stuff, you know, they could regulate others into buying it. But the challenge in that is once inflation returns, once the dollar goes up, once oil goes up, everybody's on the same side of the trade. They've all, their balance sheets are full of this stuff. And now, you know, if credit risk goes up, if rates go up, if oil goes up, they need to sell something. They all need to sell something. What are they going to sell? Who's the buyer now? And when you have no buyers, you get, you know, relative to demand, relative to net effective supply, which, as I said, is very convex. You get what we've had in the last couple of weeks, which is, you know, 10-year yield just goes up and up and up and up and up.
Luke, you said earlier that the people who thought that, you know, Russia and China crashing the treasury market by divesting their holdings didn't really understand where the vulnerabilities really are. Let's talk about where those vulnerabilities really are, because I do think we're in an environment geopolitically where nobody wants to go to nuclear war, so economic warfare is the preferred way to go. And the United States versus both Russia and China, the tension is mounting. So it only stands to reason that China and Russia would be looking for ways to injure the United States economically without having to go to kinetic warfare. What are the things that, you know, if you put yourself in the Russians and the China's shoes, what would you be doing in order to injure the United States? What risks should we be concerned about?
Well, I think you'll see them weaponize oil. I think that's the obvious first one. I know there have been a lot of people, you know, maybe not a lot, but I know there have been analysts out there that have said, well, look at Xi, he's storing up all this oil and he's clearly going to be, you know, he's clearly planning to invade Taiwan. I'm not.
He knows something. He knows what's coming.
I think he knows something. All right. I think, you know, I think Louis Gab highlighted that on your show last week or 2 weeks ago, right? I think Putin gave him the wink, wink, nod, nod. Hey, SPR's run down, shale production's peaking. Treasury market's under pressure. This winter, I'm going to properly weaponize oil and gas. And yeah, I think that's very possible.
Winter is starting. And what do you think that means? What would be the mechanism of weaponizing oil and gas if you're Russia?
Oh, the inelasticity, using the inelasticity of oil, right? Hey, I'm cutting oil production by 10%. And I'm going to shift it over to China. So China has cheap oil and cheap gas. And Europe and UK have very expensive gas. Have a good day. And, you know, interestingly, what did Russia just say? Russia just came out and said starting in January 2024, they're going to sell gas to China at half the price of Europe. Perfect. China will take all they can sell. It's just a matter of logistics. And if it's cheaper, great. So now China, it slows China's dollar outflows. And quite frankly, it's all in yuan, so they don't care. It does, actually probably doesn't affect the dollar flows at all. Russia's selling it yuan to China cheaper, and the UK and Europe are short energy. And so what do? They sell dollar assets. You know, who's like the fourth biggest holder of treasuries right now? The UK, which is a whole separate story. So it accelerates this dollar up, oil up. Treasuries have to get sold. Dollar assets have to get sold. Because, yeah, everybody needs dollars, but you know the one thing everybody needs more than dollars? Energy. I can't eat dollars. I need commodities. I got to eat food. You know, my wife's truck doesn't run on dollars. It runs on oil and gas. So that's what I think they'll do.
Let's come back to this treasury problem from the perspective of the investor who's holding treasuries. Let's talk about what the alternatives are, because I don't see many. If you've got treasuries in your portfolio really is the stability asset that's supposed to be the offset that's going to save you when there's a sell-off in the stock market, well, it hasn't been working very well for that. But, you know, what do you say if the treasury market is actually beginning to fail in slow motion, as you're describing? Well, the logical alternative, I would think, would be gold. Well, okay, gold's down $100 in the last week. It seems like that's not the bet. At least it wasn't as of last week. Maybe it is this week. What do you do instead?
I think there's a short-term answer to this, and I think there is a, you know, beyond short-term and beyond answer. The short-term answer is that treasuries are not going to work as ballast in portfolios. They're going to continue to not work. Again, this convexity of net effective issuance, foreigners have $7.5 trillion for sale. The U.S. government has $2 trillion for sale, and that assumes no recession. They put in a recession. U.S. deficits rise 6 to 12% in a recession. That's 1.6 to 3 trillion on top of the 2 trillion. So now you're looking at 3.6 to 5 trillion in U.S. issuance plus whatever, 2 trillion a year. I guess they say they only sell 2 trillion. So there's 7 trillion in net effective issuance. And rates ain't going to go down if there's net effective issuance of $5 to $7 trillion in treasury net effective issuance. And that doesn't get into the trillion that the Fed's allegedly going to sell. That doesn't get into anything that banks sell because their credit losses are going up because rates are spiraling up. Like, treasuries aren't going to work until the dollar is weakened meaningfully and oil's weakened meaningfully. And paradoxically, what you need to get oil down is either, you know, Biden to apologize to MBS, and I think it might be too late, but we'll see, or you need a severe global recession. But again, severe global recession is going to send treasury supplies up by $3 trillion plus minimum, because it's also going to send the dollar up. And so foreigners will sell more of those $7.5 trillion faster. So the whole, there's this whole narrative of like, I need to own treasuries because the Fed is going to get deflation to get a bid for treasuries. There is a fundamental misunderstanding of the convexity of net effective supply of treasuries. Supply is going to run higher, faster than demand can, because everyone has spent the last 10 years getting plugged with this stuff to offset the loss of foreign central banks. So what in the short run works, you know, in that environment, gold's not going to work either, to your point, for a bit. Gold won't work for, you know, basically the only thing that will work is cash. It's not going to work stock. You want to own dollar cash. Like, that's it. And, you know, that's, I don't know how many people can sit in 5% money market funds, but you're only going to want to be there until the treasury feedback loop I just described hits a rate where it becomes a mathematical certainty that the U.S. government cannot afford its fixed obligations, its entitlement paygos, and its interest expense without printing money. So I don't know what that rate is. You know, Jamie Dimon said the rates could go to 7. You know, yesterday he said that. You know, 7's probably pretty close to the rate where the market looks at it and goes, oh my God, this isn't the U.S. anymore. This is the U.S. with Argentine characteristics. And that's why I say in the very short run, the only thing that would work is dollar cash. Maybe oil, because the higher rates go, the more, you know, the more pressure there is on the U.S. to grow oil production. Once consensus goes, oh my God, the U.S. can't afford its fixed interest-like obligations without the Fed printing money, rates are going to go up faster, the dollar is going to go up faster, and then people are going to be really confused because all of a sudden the stock market's going to start just absolutely running. And gold's going to start absolutely running. And Bitcoin's going to start absolutely running. And this will confuse people in the same way they've been confused as to why gold has not fallen with real rates doing what they've done over the last 18 months. And the answer is it'll be the market playing by the new set of rules, which is, you know, the United States with its Argentine-like fiscal picture and its Argentine-like twin deficits and its Argentine-like political outcomes is starting to have Argentine-like markets. And so short run, cash. Beyond the short run, whenever consensus goes, oh my God, when this feedback loop in treasuries drives dollar up and rates up enough to elicit that oh my God reaction in consensus, people are going to go, I can't hold these treasuries. These are certificates of confiscation. These aren't risk-free assets. What do you sell at that point? You don't go into dollars. You go into anything that preserves your purchasing power. Because what the market will look forward to see is that the Fed's going to have to buy all this stuff. They're going to have to cap yields. And yield curve control is the Hotel California for the Fed. Their balance sheet will go from today it's 8 trillion. Yeah, it'll be a multiple 8 trillion.
Let's move on to the stock market, something that's literally just happened as we've been speaking during this interview on Tuesday, is we've dropped back below the 61.8% retracement level of the overall bear market, which was, I believe, at 43.06 on the S&P. This is the first day, and of course, this is just intraday, but as I'm speaking now, we're looking at about 42.67 on the December E-mini futures contract. So we're back down below the 61.8, which I was watching carefully to see if it was going to hold as support. Seems like maybe the stock market is officially rolled over as opposed to just looking like it was going to roll over, as we told our Macro Voices listeners a couple weeks ago. What do you make of this market? Where's it headed?
I think there's a short run outlook, and then I think there's the just beyond the short run outlook. The short run outlook, the dollar up, rates up feedback loop that will not be broken unless the Fed significantly, or unless the dollar is significantly weakened. To be clear, that can be Fed or Treasury. And oil is weakened meaningfully. The stock market is going to go down big. And that's your risk. Now, do I want to go out and short the stock market in, you know, massive size? No, I want to buy insurance protection, because I think what is about to happen is probably the trickiest trading environment any of us have ever seen in our careers. I think you're at huge downside risk in the short run And then there is, you know, it's possible you'll get a slowing or even maybe even a slight bid for treasuries, like very slight, very slight. But that'll last for a moment. And then treasury yields will start going up again. And that will be the oh my God moment. Because again, another element of this convexity of net effective supply of treasuries that consensus does not see is what you and I've talked about before, Eric, in the past, which is the stock market is the key marginal driver for U.S. consumption, U.S. GDP growth, and U.S. tax receipt growth. And people have sometimes doubted that. Last year, it was proven beyond all reasonable doubt, which is to say we didn't have a recession in 2022. Unemployment was 3.5%. Withheld taxes, so employment receipts never fell. And yet U.S. tax receipts fell by 20%. Where did it all come out of? Non-withheld receipts. What's non-withheld receipts? Capital gains and stock options, stock comp. And so this will further add to the convexity of net effective supply of treasuries. The overwhelming consensus is all we need to do is crash stocks and there'll be a bid for treasuries. Maybe for a moment. And then receipts will start crashing. Right? We saw U.S. Treasury receipts were down $500 to $600 billion last year. That was all stock and asset prices. It was stock-based comp and it was capital gains. So you crash stocks in the short run, you might get a little bit of a bid. But then all of a sudden, receipts are going to start tanking. And so again, you're actually going to increase deficits faster than you're going to increase demand for treasuries in that crash. And that's going to further add to the net effective supply of treasuries. And again, it's in part because everything that Western policymakers have done, and specifically the U.S. government has done over the last 10 years, certainly, and really going back to the Clinton era, has been to basically make demand for treasuries pro-cyclical. Everyone's on one side of the trade, out of regulation, out of tax treatment, out of all of it. And now it's going the other way. So I think it's in the short run, this treasury dollar feedback loop is horrible for stocks until treasury yields hit a rate where the solvency of the U.S. government is called into question. Now, to be clear, the U.S. government can't go insolvent. The solvency is always solved for the Fed or Treasury, one way or another, financing. You know, the Fed financing this in one way, shape, or form. Yield curve control, QE, not QE. We're only doing this to help the resilience of the Treasury market. This isn't QE. You know, whatever line they give us this time, that's what's going to happen. And then once they do that, I would encourage people to call up the stock, the chart of the Argentine stock market. Argentine pesos has been a disaster, but in peso terms, holy cow, their stock market's up like 5x in the last 3 or 4 years. Same thing's going to happen here, except it'll happen in dollar terms. Now, will the dollar collapse against the peso? No. But again, I don't care. It's going to be really good for stocks. It'll be really good for gold. That's when you'll see gold really perform. That's when you'll see Bitcoin really perform. And, you know, treasuries might actually work. If the Fed caps treasury yields at 3, hey, TLT is going to go up. But it's a very suboptimal way to express the trade because I suspect gold will be up a multiple of that, Bitcoin a multiple of that, stocks a multiple of that, commodities a multiple of that. Inflation will rip.
Well, Luke, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to ask you a little bit more about what you do at Forest for the Trees. And that's fftt-llc.com. Tell our listeners what they can expect to find there and what services you offer.
Thanks, Eric. Yeah, we have both mass market and institutional research products. And what we do is we connect dots in a unique way, often across different market and industry and sector silos, to try to find economic bottlenecks that can help our clients make money.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com. Energy Transition Crisis, my new video documentary series about energy transition, has finally been released, and anyone can watch it for free at energytransitioncrisis.org. The series explains exactly what it's really going to take to break humanity's addiction to fossil fuels and why it will take longer and cost more than almost anyone realizes. and I'd like to think the three episodes on nuclear energy are among the most detailed on YouTube. This is a passion project for me, and there's no profit motive, no revenue, and therefore no budget other than donations. I'd really appreciate your help promoting the series. Things you can do to help include subscribing to the Energy Crisis Doc YouTube channel, liking every episode, posting comments on YouTube, and posting links to your favorite episodes on social media. If you don't have time to do those things, there's also a donations page at energytransitioncrisis.org. The money does not go to me. 100% of it will be spent on YouTube and other social media advertising to promote the series. Thanks in advance for your help. Now let's get back to the show and Patrick's post-game chart deck.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Luke back on the show. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Luke's picture saying, looking for the downloads. Now, Eric, let's start off with you. Let's cover some of the crude oil, and let's start with the EIA inventory.
Patrick, crude oil was down more than 5% on Wednesday and kept moving down on Thursday morning, breaking the upsloping channel that it was trading in. EIA inventory is only part of the explanation. This story starts with the OPEC Plus meeting. No change there. As expected, OPEC did not change their production quotas. Basically, standing pat, no change. However, Russia, which had originally said that they were going to place a ban on exports of finished products such as gasoline, now they're saying maybe they're not going to do that. So even before EIA inventory came out, that resulted in a little bit of fear that maybe there's going to be too much gasoline on the market as Russia begins exporting gasoline. Then EIA inventory came out. Crude oil drawing down 2.2 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma building 132,000 barrels. Well, a build is awfully nice in Cushing because we're running out of oil there, but it's a de minimis build at 132,000 barrels. We've been having million barrel drawdowns. We really need some big builds to make up for that. But here's the big one on the board. Gasoline building 6.5 million barrels, way beyond consensus expectations. On the back of the Russian news, this is being interpreted to mean that there has been a complete collapse in demand for gasoline in the United States, signaling the beginning of the recession that everybody has been waiting for. Now, personally, I look at these EIA numbers, and I sometimes wonder how accurate the counting is, so I'm inclined to wait and see what next week's number looks like to see maybe what came in this week will come out next week. In any event, what's panicking the market is the perception, whether it's right or wrong, that there has been a complete collapse in gasoline demand. Distillates, meanwhile, drawing down 1.3 million barrels, with U.S. production remaining unchanged at 12.9 million barrels. So now the big risk is whether the stock market is going to dump on those same recession fears and bring about a trend change in crude oil. As of Thursday morning, well, we broke well below the channel. We broke the 34-day moving average. We broke the 55-day moving averages, got down to almost the 5-month moving average, seeing a little bit of a bounce on Thursday morning. I think there may still be lower to go, but at some point I do expect a resumption of the crude oil rally unless we really are going to drop into recession. So I'm watching the stock market as confirmation to see if this really is a big recession event or if it's just a short-term panic and the rally is about to resume. Now I want you to think about the scenario that Luke Grumman described in the feature interview. That is the scenario of Putin weaponizing oil prices this winter. If he were to do that, presumably he'd probably aim towards doing the most damage, i.e. the highest oil prices, right in the dead of winter, let's say around mid-February. Well, what else happens around mid-February? That's when the March futures contracts expire. On Wednesday morning, I bought 100 strike calls on the March 24 crude oil futures contract for a whopping 86 cents per barrel. And on Thursday morning, those same calls were selling for below 75 cents. I think that's an absolute bargain because when you consider the asymmetry of this trade, your maximum downside is 75 cents or 85 cents, whatever you paid for the call. if we see a weaponization of oil prices take us back to $130, $140, as some people are predicting, that trade is a, I don't know what it works out to be, 50, 75 bagger, something like that. Huge upside, and your downside is less than a buck. You risk more than that on any reasonable futures trade. So I think it's an incredible bargain, and I don't think it's a lottery ticket trade, because I think that the risk of Putin weaponizing oil prices is considerably higher than lottery ticket kind of probabilities.
Yeah, Eric, it was a crazy reversal that we saw. Obviously, it was a very strong bull trend. The $94 area lined up with the highs from October and November of last year, as well as the 50% retracement of the entire bear market. But the selling came in very hard. And I mean, we're now just a stone throw away from giving back half of the gains. What's going to be really interesting for me is when we now trade toward this $80 area, let's call it the 80 to 83 zone just here in the next few dollars. If this was and is still the bull market that I think it is, we should see buyers come in here and buy the dip right in the zone. And it shouldn't take more than by the middle of next week or maybe by next week's show for the bulls to be back in action. If we find that oil is just being sluggish and selling off and not bouncing off of these kind of key support lines, then I'd have big questions as to whether something different is underway. My first assumption, though, is that this is a buy on dip, and I think that's the best way to approach it at this juncture. Now, Eric, what are you thinking here on the S&P?
I see this week's action as absolutely critical. As you heard in the interview, we took out the 61.8% Fibonacci retracement level of the overall bear market during Luke's interview. The 200-day moving average is next. If we take that out, it seems to me that the bear market is back on and back on in spades. But I'll leave it to our technicians to opine in more detail on what's coming next. Obviously, we saw a bounce on Wednesday, but is that going to hold or is it just a dead cat? Well, time will tell.
Yeah, Eric, I agree with you on many of those. I want to first, though, get Nick involved in the conversation, and then I'll talk about some of these levels. But Nick, what levels are you watching, bud?
Spot price right now in the S&P 500 is 4260. We have a call wall above at 4300 and a put wall just below at 4200. The implied move for the October 20th OPEX is plus minus 130 points. So the upper expected move is 4390, and the lower expected move is 4130. Again, key resistance above is at 4,300 where the call wall is. We have support just below at 4,250 and then 4,200. I'm inclined to think we see some upside in the short term before resuming downside. Again, typically you don't see sell-offs where we go in a linear fashion to one direction. So we're now down about 7.5% from the year highs. We hit a low of about 8.5% to the downside from the year highs as well. We're up about 1% from that level now. And it's possible we push that 4350 mark before resuming downside. I'm not really bullish at all long term, but again, it's important to not be too bearish in the short term. If you're hedging longer term, that's fine, but taking these short term bets, trying to predict market direction is very difficult in these times.
Well, you know what, Nick, I was observing very similar oversold conditions. I mean, typically when we see this type of oversold, we'll talk about it in a few charts shortly, it would typically associate a frame where the market would typically retrace. So even a bounce towards 4,400 plus could happen. The one thing is that we're getting a lot of other warning signs, breakdown in credit markets, interest rates rise, and the dollar remains very strong, and yet we haven't seen huge spikes in volatility. We'll talk about that VIX in a second, which would be the thing that you would typically see at a turn point. And so I'm sort of torn here, where while I see the oversold conditions and agree with you in principle, sometimes to solidify a short-term trading low, you almost need a little short-term washout where the market kind of really spooks everyone out, creates that turn point, and then that could be what creates that multi-week rally on the other side. The way I'm looking at it is right now, going into the jobs numbers on Friday, if we can't beat 4,300 in any meaningful way, I still think there could be just a very fast, quick washout as low as 4,100 that kind of just brings that spike of the VIX up to 25 and then really bangs out that bottom for that counter rally that you you actually think will happen, and just might happen off a little bit lower of a level. Moving on, though, we have the NASDAQ, the QQQ chart on page 5. What levels are you watching on this?
Spot price right now on the Qs is 360. We have a call wall just above at 370 and a put wall below at 350. The implied move for the October 20th OPEX is plus minus 14 points. So the upper expected move would be 374 and the lower expected move would be 346. Key resistance is just above at 370, then 380. And key support is below at 350, right where that put wall is as well. Again, I'm inclined to think that we might see perhaps a small bounce here, but watching the Mag 7 names, you know, Google, Microsoft, Nvidia, and so forth, these names haven't really sold off too heavily over the last couple of weeks, whereas the broad market has. So if any weakness is derived in these names, we may see further downside. But I do think we see short-term bounces perhaps before we see more downside. And I do see a lot more downside ahead. So just want to clarify that point as well.
All right, Nick, on page 6, we have the volatility index, the VIX. And I find it so surprising that we had seen a similar magnitude drop like we saw during the regional bank crisis. And during that period, the VIX was spiking up to 30. Here, we can't even get a closing print above 20 on the volatility index. And this is the part that bothers me about whether or not the market can really be putting in a short-term low without us seeing some little panic come in. And I'm not talking about a big cataclysmic event or something, but rather just something where we see a fast spike to the 25 level or something to really just spook all the traders. What are you watching on the VIX?
So right now the VIX is around 19 points, which denotes about 1.25% movements each day in the broad markets. Again, we tapped that 20 mark and we rejected off that pretty hard. But if we do break above that and push that 25 to 30 level, that's where I think we get a spike toward 35. We'll probably need some kind of exogenous event that would cause that to occur, you know, some kind of credit crisis, you know, a bank failure, that kind of thing, to see, a sharp downside movement in the market, rather, which correspond with a spike in the VIX. So right now, I think what's kind of suppressing volatility a little bit is whenever we're seeing these sell-offs, premium sellers are coming out and selling premium on the put side because it's very rich, perhaps, on the zero DTE options. Additionally, a lot of funds are divesting of their longer-term equity positions right now in favor of fixed income. So what's happening there is that there's no demand for hedging in that respect. So the demand for buying puts is not there. So therefore, the volatility index isn't going to spike as hard because the VIX is predicated upon average 30-day option activity on SPX, right? So short-term, I think we may test that 20 mark, but I do think we need some kind of event to actually trigger a pop to 25 or 30, perhaps.
It'll be interesting to see whether the jobs numbers offer that event. The last thing I wanted to touch on here is on page 7. I have the number of stocks on the New York Stock Exchange that are above their 50-day moving averages, and we've just hit 15%. Whenever we get this oversold, at least in the last few years, it is very close to where a tradable low happens, and this kind of supports your idea that we could see a market bounce. We are definitely oversold. We had a very big move, and the typical reaction is for the market to bounce. I just think that maybe we first go down before that bounce really engages.
Yeah, Patrick, I'm in agreement there. You know, these rapid rallies that occur during bear markets, they happen out of nowhere and they catch a lot of people off guard. So it wouldn't surprise me at all to see, you know, a 3 to 5% move to the upside before a decline. But again, I'm more bearish overall. Short term, I see a bounce that 4350 mark, as you mentioned, perhaps a 4400 level. But that's all I see right now in the short term. Now, moving on to page 8, we have the US dollar index. Now, Eric, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts here.
Last week, I said I was getting concerned. Well, now I'm more concerned. The Dixie has been moving up in a straight line since mid-July, with hardly a day-long correction along the way. If Brent Johnson is right, and this move is pushing us to test a new high, we could be headed toward 122 on the Dixie. And I say that will break a lot of things, starting with EM debt. I admit that I'm not sure what else. I guess I am sure that U.S. debt is certainly going to be there. The U.S. government's ability to finance its own borrowing is going to come into question. But I also predict there's lots of other not-so-obvious consequences and knock-on effects. I don't pretend to know what they they all are. But if this starts to happen, we'll scramble to get the right guests on the show to talk about it.
Yeah, the view that the U.S. dollar index can, you know, clear the 115 level or head up to 120, while I think that it could be a story for next year, I think on the short term, we are seeing some pretty overbought conditions. The yen is, the U.S. dollar yen's approaching 150, where there's speculation of intervention. The euros and the pound sterling both very oversold. And so it wouldn't shock me if we have a throwback in the dollar that is just purely a tactical retracement that offers buy on dips. The 50-day moving average lies around the 105 level, and the retracements and previous highs are all in that 104 or 105 pocket. So I'm thinking here, if we pull back one or two handles on the downside, it probably will offer a compelling buy on dip, but I'm slowly and cautiously waiting to see whether or not the dollar pauses here in that advance.
Now, moving on to page 9, we have the gold futures chart. What are your thoughts here?
The weakness in gold is entirely about the dollar and interest rates backing up, with the 10-year nearing 5%. The next obvious support is the March lows at 1815 on gold, but if the 10-year really is headed towards 7%, as some people are starting to suggest, gold could still have much lower to go. And if the stock market crashes, it will take gold with it, at least initially. Gold really is holding up pretty well considering rates, but where are rates headed next? I still have max conviction that when the Fed is eventually forced to reverse course and cut rates, gold will soar. But it's entirely possible it will soar from a lower base well below the current market. And it's also possible that the Fed won't capitulate nearly as soon or as easily as market participants assume.
Eric, from a price action perspective, gold is incredibly weak, but it is actually finishing what we call a measured move on the downside, approaching some interesting supports from its March lows. This is also a market that could easily bounce, particularly if we see a swing high of some form on the dollar, and we have, let's say, a 1 week or 2 week pullback. That would offer an opportunity for gold to bounce back toward 1900. But I think it is reasonable to assume that gold may need to go through an extended bottoming formation or basing formation before it can establish a new uptrend. So I would not trust any short-term rally and still be looking for some more retesting that could maybe even go as low as 1800. In the bigger context, I think that's all going to be actually a very interesting buy-on-dip opportunity in there, but I don't see an imminent reason why gold should start rising other than just a very oversold bounce that it's now overdue for. I wanted to just touch on three other quick charts here. And on page 10, I wanted to just touch on a Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, which at this stage has had an epic bull run, and very similar to oil, it's put in a swing high and is retracing. Now, the pullback has been nowhere near the magnitude that crude oil has been seeing, but it is certainly now 10% off of its highs. And the question is being asked as to whether there's a little bit more of a pullback coming. At this stage, I actually think old dips can and should be bought and can be bought on uranium. The bigger question is, does this Sprott Physical pull back another dollar or more before the that buying opportunity really is there? On the page 11, I wanted to also just touch on the RBOB gasoline futures. And when we were looking at oil and the pullback in oil, it looks nowhere near as ugly as this November contract on gasoline. And we were at almost $2.70 a gallon, and we wiped out down to $2.20, a 50-cent pullback that has now got it back into the dead center of its 2023 trade range before the breakout. It just gave everything back. And anything that can have this magnitude of selling is a warning sign that at least some sort of an intermediate high may have formed. Again, when something is this oversold, we could easily bounce back to 230, 235. But that's where the previous highs from 2022 and 23 were. And that would be a place where I would now start looking for gasoline futures to have some resistance as we move forward. Moving on to page 12, I really want to just touch on junk bonds. And on what we have here is a material breakdown in junk bonds as credit spreads finally started to rise. This, to me, was the canary in the coal mine of when tight credit conditions would get into these high-yield bonds. And to me, while the damage has been done in the treasury bond market that Luke was talking about earlier in the interview, to me, this is really where the stresses on the stock market will become evident. If this junk bond breakdown continues, I think that this is quite bearish for the equity markets, and it should not be ignored.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview and the chart deck we just discussed here in the postgame, including a number of links to articles that we found really interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you've not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.